Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Clinical Support Manager at VetsNow, Louise O'Dwyer. Thank you, Louise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're all relaxing at work. I've taken an hour out. I'm currently in the hospital where I work in Manchester, so I'm hopefully it's not going to be noisy in the background, and I've just escaped from theatre. So as we said, this session's looking at wound management and looking specifically about dealing with wounds when we're maybe seeing them and they're not healing in that normal time frame, or we're aware that potentially there is something else going on. You know, we do see a number of patients where they will have things like mast cell tumours that can interfere with wound healing. These patients could have, you know, comorbidities, so some other underlying disease that are affecting them. But it just kind of, it's the presentation really talks through the way I deal when I have a wound that isn't going in the right direction in the time frame I would expect to have healed in, and kind of like my thought process is really on dealing with these wounds. I think what's really important, and especially as nurses, I think for me, you know, wound healing and wound management are one of the things that nurses can become really involved in. I tend to find vets will deal with them for a period of time, and then they're more than happy to hand them over to the nursing team for them to continue to, you know, dress them and deal with these wounds and bandage them on an appropriate basis. But what's really important to a really good understanding of is knowing how wound healing actually occurs. And I think this is something we often can tend to forget, and kind of knowing what time frame should be normal, and then we can start to figure exactly what could be the cause as why these wounds aren't healing as they should be. So wound healing, it really is quite a complicated process, and as we said, how we treat the wound depends on the stage of wound healing that wound's at. So the dressings that we're putting on right at the beginning of that wound, we're not going to be using, you know, probably 3, 4, 5 weeks down the line. You know, we're going to change those dressings to match that wound environment at that point in time. So for us, it's really important that we understand those processes that occur around all these different stages of wound healing, so we can tailor our treatment to get the best possible outcome. And so that's what I'm going to sort of talk about briefly, the different stages of wound healing. And when we think about wound healing, basically it's the physiological process of restoring that continuity of tissues following some sort of injury or surgery. And we generally divide wound healing up into two main processes, regeneration and repair. So regeneration is the replacement of lost cells or tissues with normal functioning cells of the same type. And only tissue or organs that have a cell population that can undergo mitosis, so our epithelia, bone and liver are also applicable, can heal in this way. If that process is not possible, then in most mammalian tissues, that healing will occur by repair. So this is the formation of a fairly avascular collagen-rich scar, which holds together the edges of that wound. So when we think about what normal wound healing, it's a continuous event, but we generally look at dividing it into four main stages. We have technically hemostasis, then we've got the inflammatory stage, we have a debridement stage, we've got a proliferative or repair stage, and then we've got a maturation or a remodeling stage. And again, we want to know roughly how long each of these stages are going to take, so we've got some idea of whether things are progressing in the way that we'd expect them to progress for that wound at that point in time. So as we said, we've got all these different phases going on. So this is a little graph created by Georgie Hollis that runs the Veterinary Wound Library that kind of talks through these different stages and gives us kind of a time frame as a graph. So as we said, we get hemostasis and inflammation. So we get that injury, and after that injury occurs, we're going to get some immediate hemorrhage. Now you can kind of think that hemorrhage has got some degree of purpose, that hemorrhage will, I can't even say lavage, but it will, you know, to a certain extent help flush out some things from that wound, not an awful lot. So we get that hemorrhage, and then we get basically a vasoconstriction. We then get shortly afterwards a vasodilation, and then what we start to get is heat clotting. So we get platelet aggregation, we get the release of growth factors from those platelets. It's really important, and again, this is why having an understanding of what's happening within a wound is important. It's important that everything can function in a normal way. Because, for example, those platelets, they reach little extensions and contact each other and kind of form a bit more of a plug. But actually, they release their contents and they release growth factors and other inflammatory mediators that are going to be important in terms of triggering that next phase of wound healing. They're also important because they are going to send out chemical signals and they're going to bring other cells into that wound environment. So they're going to bring in neutrophils and lymphocytes and macrophages that are going to work, and we'll see this in a second, in different stages. So all that will generally happen immediately following injury, as we said, through to normally a few days. We see inflammation for around, 5 to 6 days after that injury occurs. So as we said, those platelets will send out chemical signals, bring other cells into that local wound environment. The first cells that we're going to get are neutrophils. They'll appear at that site of injury within about the first 24 hours. And again, they have a particular function in terms of they're trying to control infection as much as possible. They're that first line defense. And then what will happen is macrophages will follow neutrophils and replace their activity by triggering that next phase of wound healing, again through releasing growth factors and through releasing cytokines. So being able to making sure that all these cells can do the jobs that they need to do and have a good and the thing that we're normally looking for is maintaining a moist wound environment so that can happen. But making sure all of this can happen is hugely important. When we get inflammation, what do we start to see? Well, when looking at the wound, we can generally see that there will be noticeably more exudate. So exudate is kind of the fluid that's produced by wounds. Generally, it's comprised of water. It will also contain some nutrients, some oxygen, some antibodies, some white blood cells. And when we start to see things going wrong, so if we start to have a wound that's infected, what we will start to see is a change in the volume or the type of exudate that we see in that wound. We'll all be familiar with the fact that it starts to look more purulent. Again, exudate has a function. If we use it correctly with the correct types of dressings, it's going to help to maintain that moist wound environment to a certain extent. But again, things can start to go wrong, and we can have points at which there is just too much exudate. And then again, we need to look at dressings that can absorb that. Because if the wounds, and particularly the healthy, intact skin around that wound, becomes too wet, it gets what we call macerated, and it's really easily damaged. If you think about if you stay in the bath for too long, your fingers and your toes go all crinkly, and that skin's much easier to damage. If you've ever left kind of a wet plaster on a finger or anything like that, you'll see that skin change, and it's much more fragile, it's much more friable. So as I said, looking at what we've got going on in terms of that exudate is really important. Next stage of wound healing is the repair phase. So this repair phase is basically where we start to get new tissues being formed. So we start to get angiogenesis, we start to get the formation of new blood vessels, we'll start to get that formation of granulation tissue. And so granulation tissue is that kind of tissue that looks a little bit like raw meat, is the only way to describe it. It looks a bit like raw steak. So we know that it should be a nice pale pink colour. It tends to have a fairly granular appearance to it as well. It's not perfectly smooth. During this phase, we're also going to start to get fibroblasts in the wound and collagen formation. So we're going to start to get more strength within that wound. We also, our fibroblasts will be changed to myofibroblasts as well, and they are going to start to contract down, and that will help to shrink down the size of that wound. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. So again, this repair phase, that will start pretty quickly. And what's important to remember is, at any point in that wound, you can have different parts of that wound undergoing different stages of wound healing. So it doesn't all occur in kind of distinct, separate zones. Lots of things will be overlapping. As you can see, this starts to happen, 2 to 3 days in, and it will take months to sometimes years before it's fully completed. In terms of proliferation, in terms of granulation tissue, as we said, nice healthy granulation tissue should be uneven in texture, like a steak is uneven, granular looking, and it should be a nice pink and red color. And when we dress those wounds on these patients, when we take a wound dressing off, it shouldn't that granulation tissue shouldn't be so fragile that it bleeds really easy. If it bleeds really easily, there's something going wrong. If we've got unhealthy granulation tissue, what you'll see is it becomes much darker red in colour and it is much more friable. It will bleed more readily, particularly when we take those dressings off before we can put a new one on. And one of the things that commonly has gone wrong when we start to see this in wounds is that there's either infection, or probably for me the thing that I've seen most commonly is poor oxygen supply. So wounds require oxygen not only from our red blood cells carrying oxygen bound to hemoglobin, but actually what's really important, and an awful lot of technology goes into dressings to make sure this can happen, is that oxygen needs to be able to get into that wound and carbon dioxide out. And if that can't happen, we get a reduction in the oxygen tension at the surface of that wound, and it starts to change healing, so things will slow down. And as we said, that granulation tissue will really change in colour. A good example of when I've seen this happen is when owners have had, you know, and they're very useful, big kind of waterproof neoprene boot dressings, or where they've put plastic bags onto feet, and instead of taking them off, particularly one with the neoprene ones, where they think, well, this is okay, it's just another kind of bandage layer. But actually that neoprene will reduce the amount of oxygen that's able to get through, even through all those bandage layers and into that wound bed itself. The other thing that we can see, to be honest, not so much in small animals, unless we really overdo it with dressings, but in large animal wound healing, it's a massive problem. So is overgranulation. So overgranulation is where literally we get too much granulation tissue growing up. Certain types of dressings, if we're not careful, can encourage the growth of granulation tissue. And this tends to be softer, it's more edematous, it often looks shinier, it's paler, and it will stick up above the surrounding tissue. And the problem is when this happens, is you've got to go in and cut it back, because otherwise all those new epithelial cells that we want to migrate across that wound bed are not going to be able to do that as effectively. Epithelialization, as I've just said, this is going to happen once that granulation tissue has filled that wound cavity. And what I remember when I'm thinking about debriding wounds is that anything that's functional within a wound will produce new epithelial cells. So a sweat gland, a hair follicle, anything will produce an epithelial cell. And that's why when I'm debriding wounds, I think about, do I really need to take this tissue away? So anything normal that I can leave behind, even if it's a big wound and it's got some islands of tissue in it, I'll leave those behind. And again, this is why it's important that we have moist wound healing, because those squamous cells, those epithelial cells as well, are going to migrate over the surface of that wound. They're going to leapfrog over each other until they reach each other and we get what's called contact inhibition. Once they meet each other, they stop being produced. But you need a moist wound environment for that to happen properly. That tissue is going to be really delicate, so again, we want to make sure we're using appropriate dressings that aren't going to damage that. I also want to think about using dressings that I can leave in place for as long as possible, because every time I change a dressing, I'm removing some of those cells that have taken, you know, however many, you know, maybe we're changing these dressings every 4 days. You know, you will set that wound back to a certain extent when you remove that dressing, because you're going to take some of those cells with it. So again, if I can get a dressing that can stay in place for 7 days, that's what I'm going to do. It's going to save money in terms of bandaging fees, but also I definitely would say that you see wounds healing much more quickly when you disturb them, not as much. We then get the maturation phase, and again, that maturation phase starts pretty early on and it will continue for, you know, months, years. So with the maturation phase, the cellularity of granulation tissue is reduced because some of those cells that were there before don't need to be there. So fibroblasts and endothelial cells are going to start to die back. We have those blood vessels start to die back because wound healing is kind of almost done, apart from we need it just to continue to gain strength. So you tend to see a much paler wound. Collagen fiber bundles that were originally fairly haphazard become much more organized along the lines of tension. So they become thicker, they get cross-linking, and they take on that specific orientation along the lines of tension, which you'll know about when you talk about what direction you make wounds in to make sure they don't gape open too much and they're easier to close. What we see is a reduction in the collagen content of the extracellular matrix because there's less collagen being produced and it's being broken down. So again, this doesn't, you know, is happening all the way through that process. So you can see how you can end up with several things going on at any one time. So yeah, I apologize, these are human wounds. With maturation, what we're going to see, that scar is going to lose its red appearance, that granulation tissue starts to die back. If that wound had a scab, that scab would come off and we'd be able to see what was going on beneath that wound. And then finally, we've got contraction. So contraction is the reduction in wound size that corresponds to changes in the tension around the wound and the surrounding tissues. It's that shrinking down that we see. And this is massively important in veterinary wounds. It happens much more more effectively in animal wounds compared to human wounds. When you take that dressing off and you think that wound is halved in size compared to what it was last time, 5 days ago, a lot of that isn't about really healing and producing new cells. A lot of it is about contraction. And we start to see contraction happening around a week in following that injury. And as I said, it's a really important part of wound healing. And again, we need to make sure we're using dressings that don't stop that contraction from happening. It's very easy to put the wrong type of dressing on that splints that wound open and stops that process from occurring that would help reduce the size of that wound. And as we said, all of these things don't happen in one big, you know, in separate distinct times. We can see they're all happening. You can almost get to a point where you've got almost all of those stages at any one point. So again, it's having that understanding of what's happening that's going to help you then go on and pick what dressings we're going to use. There are things that are fairly predictable in terms of wound healing, in terms of things that are going to stop wounds from healing normally, and we generally divide these up into wound factors, so kind of really local factors, patient factors, and also surgeon factors as well. So these are some of the common impediments that we see with wound healing. Infection is a common issue that we see, particularly if you've got patients with bite wounds and things like that. If you've got foreign material, so again, animals get hit by cars, dragged along the road, they get full of gravel and leaves and soil and debris. Necrotic tissue is foreign material, and if we don't take that necrotic tissue away by appropriate debridement, then the body has to do that itself. Seroma, hematoma formation, if we've got too much movement, we mentioned it already, poor oxygen supply, poor blood supply, nutrition, overall health, damage during surgery, and foreign material placed during surgery are all common reasons. And we can do, you know, we can do in those initial stages of wound healing something very easily about those first three factors. You know, we do it all the time. We debride wounds, we treat them for infection on a regular basis without really thinking that we're getting rid of some of those impediments to wound healing, but that's just what we're doing. And also we want to really stop, and I'm going to talk about etiology as one of the things that I talk about. Stop and think about how that wound's been created and the risk factors for that wound because of the way it was created. So if we're thinking about wounds where infection is an issue and contamination, you know, we all know that it's not just the number of bacteria, but it's the bacterial population and it's the environment into which those bacteria are placed as well. We've all fallen over and scraped our knees or our hands and normally don't need to go to the doctors and don't need antibiotics. If you've ever been bitten by a cat, it's probably been a much, much smaller wound. But you know, for me certainly, if I don't get some antibiotics, I'm going to get an infection and it potentially, you know, cellulitis, abscesses, what have you. And that's because with those cat bites, they're pushing bacteria deep down into a small non-draining wound where those bacteria have got an ideal environment to replicate, multiply, and kind of start to overwhelm our defense system, really. So as I mentioned already, factors that we can anticipate, we've got certain factors that we can anticipate from that wound's etiology, and I'm going to talk through those first when I talk about wound factors. I'm also going to mention infection again, movement, foreign material, and necrotic tissue too. So wound etiology, you know, if you look at these two wounds, these are both wounds on the forelimbs of a dog. Yeah, so theoretically, same thing, but they're not the same. So the dog on the right jumped through some glass doors, and what he's got is basically an incision and almost a surgical injury. It was a nice clean cut. You know, we can see, you know, there's not going to require too much debridement to those wound edges. Yes, we can be concerned, you know, that obviously that skin's been torn back from underlying structures. There's potentially vascular damage. But what we did that with that wound is we put a wet to dry on it for 12 hours and then we actually sutured it closed and it was fine. The wound on the left is a dog that was dragged under a truck. The truck driver actually put this kind of tourniquet on there. So this dog has got, you know, multiple fractures, probably tendon ligament injuries and massive tissue loss, not to mention the fact that he's got significant blood loss as well. So that wound, actually, that limb was salvageable. So the owner wanted to go for surgery. So this the dog had a period of open wound management just so we could get rid of some of that infection. If you've been dragged under a lorry, there's going to be a lot of debris. We knew there was going to be a lot of necrotic tissue in that wound. So again, our first priority was getting on top of that infection, then looking at surgical repair of those orthopaedic injuries, and then looking at what we can do in terms of soft tissue repair. So there's a massive deficit, soft tissue deficit, and that's going to have to be replaced by tissues elsewhere somehow, so flaps or grafts on that patient's body. But that limb was able to be salvaged. The other one I think is a great example is dog bite wounds. So this was a little staffie that came into my previous practice. She had been attacked by another dog in the park, and these photos, the top two photos, are taken the morning after, and you can see, you know, that dog when she presented had some puncture wounds. By this point we can see there's a large amount of necrotic tissue, and I think we all, well, you can see it from the bottom photo, but we all know that this is going to look significantly worse before it starts to look better. And you know, as you can see, the problem that we've got with bite wounds is, yes, we've got those canine teeth puncturing deep down, damaging the tissues, but also the carnassials as well. Those carnassials apply huge amounts of pressure. We get kind of an ischemic injury, which is why if you look at that bottom photo, you can see we've got that massive tissue loss. We got on top of the infection pretty quickly, but it was that crushing injury caused kind of contusions that resulted in further tissue loss. And this is why we really shouldn't rush to go in and try and do something final in terms of dealing with these wounds, because we know things are going to look significantly worse before they start to look better in these patients. And this is what we actually did with her. We did a reasonably long period of open wound management. What we've got is basically, as you can see on that wound on the left-hand side, we've got now got quite a nice, healthy-looking pink granulation bed. And what our plan was that this was going to take a long, long time to heal. It was also going to take cause a lot of scarring as well. So they decided to go with a superficial caudal epigastric flap, which is what's happening in this top right photo. So dogs and cats are pretty amazing, and they have areas of the body where they've got direct cutaneous arteries and veins. So these arteries and veins are fairly superficial, but they are big, and they run, you can see, they run along here. So they run along where we're taking this flap. So we rely on having this really good blood supply. They're also the thoracic ones that we can do kind of over the scapula as well. So what we did is we raised this bed of tissue that contains that artery and that vein, and basically swung that round by 45 degrees to cover that deficit. So what you can see on that bottom photo here is that tissue flap that we've taken from here. We've swung it round and sutured it in place. You can see she's got some nipples along her side. That's the worst that happens. That's fine. What we've also got in is a couple of active suction drains that are just getting rid of any exudate that's likely to produce. That gets rid of too much if we get a reasonable amount of hemorrhage. And what we want to happen is it to create negative pressure. These active suction drains are really useful because they create what's called an atmospheric bandage effect. So it's, instead of us having to bandage the whole of that dog, yes, we would have dressed her because we dress all those wounds, post-surgical wounds, for a couple of days, but actually instead of having to bandage the whole of that dog, we were able to bandage kind of, we were able to get away with a light dressing to cover it, but actually these suction drains take away that fluid and allow that flap that we've created to adhere down onto that granulation tissue without having to put lots of sutures, tacking sutures, things like that. So those active suction drains, the dog's going to stay in the hospital, and we will empty them regularly, check how much volume is being produced, and then they generally stay in for about 2 to 4 days until we're happy that we've got good adherence of that flap to that to that underlying granulation tissue. And she went on and healed really, really well. We actually repeated the process on the other side because she had a really quite extensive, two extensive wounds. And what happened as well, where you've lost that flap, where you're left with that kind of that skin deficit, because we're taking it from an area where there's a reasonable amount of free skin and tissue around it, it means we can get away with just closing it primarily. So it worked really well. The owner also was bitten pretty badly when we tried to get that dog off his dog, and actually he was still continuing to have treatment months after his dog was done and dusted and home and healed completely. So it just goes to show how amazing animals are when it comes to healing. Infection, as we said, infected wounds are going to heal much more slowly than non-infected wounds, and it's not unusual to get a mixture of bacterial infections So yeah, aerobic, anaerobic mixed infections are very common. If you do have an animal, so I don't necessarily swab all wounds if I'm concerned when they come in about them being infected. We can take a swab at that point and keep it, send it away later. But if we've got a wound that's progressing and we aren't exactly sure, what type of bacteria we're dealing with, maybe we're concerned that it could be something resistant, what we will generally do is take a macerated tissue culture. So we take almost like a punch biopsy rather than the surface swab, because what the problem with surface swabs is that you're going to grow the bacteria that you see in your practice all the time. So kind of we know if you look at culture and sensitivity results coming back from wounds and things like that, you know that you'll see the same types of bacteria because they're commonly found within your clinic. So we want to get a really good representation rather than just getting what's on the surface. We generally send those cultures away for aerobic, anaerobic, mycobacterial, and fungal cultures. And if we were concerned about, as we said, anything else going on, mast cell tumours, things like that, we could also send that biopsy off for histopathology. Infected wounds, much as they can look horrendous, will generally, on the whole, provided we use an appropriate antibiotics, will respond really well to aggressive open wound management. And by aggressive, I mean, appropriate debridement. That's going to take several days just getting on top of that infection. We can also potentially look at using topical antimicrobials. I'm not going to do a lot on wound dressings here, but I'm a big fan of topical antimicrobials for getting on top of infection at the site. Movement's another thing. So if we've got too much movement at the site of that wound or in the surrounding tissues, that's going to slow down wound healing. And that happens because it disrupts the capillary buds. And that results in more collagen being laid down within that wound. And what we get ultimately is a wound that's a chronic inflammatory wound. So it's just kind of almost stagnant and not doing anything particularly well. On the other hand, if we get a total lack of movement, that can be counterproductive because we actually want those collagen fibers to become organized along the lines of tension or the lines of stress. And if there's no movement at all, that's not going to happen. So this was a dog with a wound on its elbow, and this had been going on for months. And what we actually did was we actually changed the incision and made an incision at a different site. So we made an incision down the side that allowed us to debride this, undermine the edges, and close it, and then deal with the wound on the side as an open wound. But because the wound on the side wasn't had no, nowhere near as much movement as on the back of the elbow, it healed much more reliably and non-problematically as well. Foreign bodies, foreign material, another common reasons why we see wounds not healing. We know that if there is some foreign material left behind in a wound, then some of it is going to be removed by those phagocytes. They're going to do the best to come in, clear that wound up as much as they possibly can do. Some of that material can become encapsulated and become effectively inert. Sometimes what we'll get is a sinus tract forming, weeks, months, even years down the line. But also what we want to remember is that suture material itself is a foreign material, and bacteria can become attached to the surface of suture material and create things like biofilms that can be very, very difficult to treat. So again, it's just really about planning ahead and trying to use appropriate debridement techniques to get as rid of as much as that foreign material as is physically possible. Necrotic tissue, the other one, so it's a little bit like foreign material. If you've got any necrotic or devitalized tissue, that's really going to slow down wound healing. What we also want to do with necrotic tissue is give it time for us to see what's viable and what's non-viable. We'll often draw on patients' skin so that we can see what's going on, what we think definitely needs to go, what we're concerned about, and then we will debride that in kind of a stage process or something like that. So again, it's really planning ahead, making sure we can see what definitely needs to be removed or what potentially needs to be removed. This actually is an interesting case. This actually isn't necrotic tissue in a wound. So this was a cat that the owner wasn't sure if it had been bitten by a dog or a fox or something like that. So this cat came home with these big bite wounds on its lower abdomen. And I was actually on holiday for a week, and I came back after a week, and the staff said, "Look, we've got this wound, and it just is permanently infected and necrotic. We debride it, we dress it, we look at it the next day, and it just looks like this again." And when I looked at it, you can probably look, and it's kind of almost looks a little charred, if that makes sense. It looks a little bit cooked. And they've been treating this with Manuka honey and foam, which I am a big fan of Manuka honey. But again, this case just shows how it's important to have an understanding of what's going on in the wound and how wound dressings work. So what we think had happened is that Manuka honey has got a very, very low pH. It's really quite acidic. In humans, they will often say that it stings when you apply it to that wound. Also, it releases very, very small amounts of hydrogen peroxide. Now, if any of you are, I'm not going to say if any of you are old as me, if any of you have been nursing a reasonable length of time like I have, you may remember hydrogen peroxide being used on rabbit abscesses. It would froth like a volcano. It doesn't do anything like that. What that hydrogen peroxide does, it releases, it causes, increases the oxygen tension at the wound. So in some ways it's beneficial, provided you've got an infected wound. So we think what was happening in this patient is the infection. We dealt with the infection, but actually that they were getting kind of either a hydrogen peroxide burn or an acidic burn. And actually what we did was we switched to a different type of topical antimicrobial for several days and it healed beautifully. So actually we think it was the Manuka honey causing the problem, which again just goes to show how vitally important it is to have that good understanding of how things work and how these dressings work and when they should be used and when they shouldn't be used. Patient factors, again, really, really quite varied from blood supply to nutrition to health status to other factors as well. So poor blood supply is going to affect a wound, and that can be because we've damaged, lacerated, really impaired regional blood supply to an area. Not only is it down to things like big, you know, major lacerations, so major blood vessel disruption, but as we kind of talked about to a certain extent with bite wounds, if you get, you know, crushing injuries that cause thrombosis or edema or contusions, that's going to cause problems. It's going to cause ischemia. It's going to damage that microcirculation and cause tissues to die back and stop them healing as well. Also, anemia is another one. Kind of, it makes sense, but, you know, you rely on your red blood cells to carry that oxygen around the body. If they're not there in appropriate amounts, then that's going to slow things down. And also, we can see it with a delay in capillary formation as well. So, you know, we'll look at how anemic patients are and think, you know, is this going to be an issue? Do we need to look at transfusing them? And poor nutritional and health status, so debilitated, older patients are going to heal much more slowly than younger patients. It is just one of those facts. You know, if patients have got nutritional deficiencies, it will impair wound healing, and it's also going to interfere with that patient's ability to fight infection. So those patients are likely to develop wound infections. If patients aren't getting good nutrition, what we need to remember is that wounds have got increased protein, increased carbohydrate requirements to get them to heal, even though patients may not be getting in that much protein. So making sure that animals are on a really good diet is important. Hyperproteinemia, if you get an albumin less than 20 grams per, hyperalbuminemia, should I say, if you get an albumin less than 20 grams per litre, that will impede wound healing. So again, if you do have patients where they've got really quite extensive wounds or they've had massive amounts of surgery, you know, we all know it, but really making sure we address nutrition early on in those patients is really, really important. So they're getting the calories and they're getting the protein in that they need to heal those wounds. Other local factors are things like poorly draining wounds. So as we talked about the little staffy that got bitten by the dog, we put these active suction drains in. So those active suction drains remove all that fluid that's likely to accumulate if you get a lot of dead space. That dog, that little dog that had that superficial caudal epigastric flap done, we know that that would have been really likely to fill up with fluid underneath that wound, and that would have potentially caused that flap to break down, which is why we looked at putting things like active drains into those patients. We've all seen them, we've all been there when we've got seromas and hematomas and things like that. The downside, particularly with things like seromas, is that they look unsightly. I mean, look at the one on the back of this Dalmatian's neck, it's huge. And they really annoy owners, they annoy us, but owners really want them draining. And the problem is if we drain them, we risk introducing infection through and bacteria by that needle passing through that patient's skin. So generally we want to, really as much as we can, plan and make sure they don't happen rather than being reactive to them as well. And finally, in our factors, there are surgeon factors as well. So we've got iatrogenic factors, so things like how that incision is made, you know, how we achieve hemostasis. So whether it's forceps, whether it's ligatures, whether it's electrocautery, all have got the potential to damage tissues. Yeah, you know, you all know good surgeons. Good surgeons are the ones where they are gentle in terms of handling tissues. They don't have to put tons of suture material in there. They're, you know, look like they're naturally gifted at being able to do this. But all that can create issues. we want to try and minimise those issues as much as we can do. So using really small gauge suture material, all that suture material needs to do is hold together the edges of tissues until they've healed. So it doesn't need to be really thick. It doesn't need to last for long, long periods of time. I think probably most people are using them now, but certainly using atraumatic needles as much as is at all possible. So again, hopefully gone are the days where people were using, I can't remember the words, those needles that you would reuse with suture material that's on a reel. Now I think hopefully most of us are using suede on suture material that have got really, really sharp needles, so they're going to be less traumatic to the skin. Making sure appropriate suture patterns are being used. So again, all your sutures in skin need to do is hold together in good apposition the edges of that patient's skin. They shouldn't be under any tension. If you've got sutures that are under tension, they're going to be painful. They're likely to blade, you know, they're likely to cheese wire through. Those animals are going to interfere with them. They're likely to chew at them because they are more uncomfortable. So it's making sure we use appropriate patterns, not under too much tension, and using the least amount of suture material possible without being ridiculous about it. But yeah, you don't need lots and lots and lots. Other iatrogenic factors include bandage injuries. So again, one of the things as nurses we're probably all worried about is creating an ischemic bandage injury. You get about a 48 hours window from applying a bandage to it being basically, if something goes wrong with it being non-salvageable. And this is why giving owners advice is really important. Giving owners written advice that they can look at when they go home, because, you know, this top, the bottom left one, a bit of a bandage injury, not too horrendous. Top right, this was a dog that had a closed metatarsal fracture, so no skin wounds whatsoever. A vet applied a Robert Jones bandage to it. They told them that it needed to stay on for X number of weeks, and they took the dog back in after 2 days because he was really unhappy, really chewing at that bandage, trying to get it off. And he gave them a buster collar and said, no, he has to keep it on. There you go. So they came into us about another week after that, something like that. And they brought the dog in because the smell of that dog's necrotic foot was becoming too overwhelming. And that was why they brought him in. And we took that Robert Jones off, and this is what we found underneath. This dog was euthanized, and it was actually euthanized because it got tetanus, not because of, you know, we could have fixed that. But yeah, it was the tetanus that the owners couldn't afford to have treated. So a really sad case, but just shows how, for me, being really methodical, you know, being skilled at applying Robert Joneses and all types of bandages is really, really important. Corticosteroids are the other thing that will slow down wound healing. So corticosteroids will suppress acute and chronic inflammatory signs within wounds. They will slow down angiogenesis, they'll slow down fibroplasia, they will slow down or certainly reduce that wound contraction. Steroids includes the use of topical corticosteroids, so our creams, things like that, but also exogenous corticosteroids themselves can encourage infection by suppressing macrophages and neutrophils. Again, the things that we really, really don't want to happen. We want that hope, that wound to have good defences that don't get overwhelmed. So whenever I'm dealing with a wound, I stop and think, what stage is that wound at that point in time? Is there still inflammation? Is there still infection? Is it contaminated? Has it got necrotic tissue? If it's got formative, if it's got necrotic tissue, do we need to debride it further? If so, how are we going to do it? Are we going to do it conscious? Are we going to anaesthetise that patient to do some sharp debridement? We want to think about appropriate dressings, as I mentioned earlier, so making sure we've got dressings that absorb sufficient amounts of exudate and also hold that exudate within the dressing, draw it away from the wound. The other thing that we want to happen is to make sure that we don't promote infection. Ideally, using things like we said, antimicrobial dressings that can kill off the bacteria within the dressing itself. Not everyone's going to have access to those, but I really, really do like the use of antimicrobial dressings, either instead of or as well of antibiotics in appropriate patients. I look to see if that wound is granulating. So when a wound is granulating, we obviously don't want anything that's going to stick down to it that we then rip off when we change that dressing. So it wants to be non-adherent. Also, we want that dressing to maintain a moist wound environment as well. And as I said earlier on, we want to make sure that wound doesn't get splintered open. One of the things that I've seen is people using manuka honey with kind of melaleucin-type dressings where the manuka honey can dry out and go crispy, stuck onto that dressing, which then goes rock hard and splints that wound open. And, you know, we probably don't get, you know, we won't get anywhere near as big of a reduction in terms of contraction in that wound because of that happening. So things like manuka honey, we would generally most of the time, I think, use them in dressings as they come or in combination with foam dressings. We'll look to see if there is any chronic granulation tissue or if that's a concern for us as well. If we do have chronic granulation tissue, we would look to debride in that, maybe something like a wet to dry dressing, just to try and kickstart that process of wound healing off again. Also, there are some things that we can look at. So calcium alginate dressings potentially could be useful. Calcium alginate, a lot of you maybe remember Caltastat that we used to use in dentals for packing dental sockets for its hemostatic properties. Actually, it works by stimulating cells in terms of wound healing. So it could be another option for these types of patients where everything's slowed right down. And when we get wounds that have just stopped altogether, we get these static wounds. We need to figure out what's going on. So we need to investigate the cause of anything non-healing. And as I mentioned earlier on, potentially looking at biopsying that wound to see have we got any neoplasia to assess the overall systemic condition of that patient. This is a little cat that got a bit bitten again, like the other cat on his bottom belly, and particularly on that bottom belly fat is very avascular. The blood supply is poor, which means even when they're on antibiotics, it's just not getting into that area. So actually, what we did with this cat, as you can see, but he's got a little midline skin incision, is we actually went into his abdomen through his abdominal wall, and got some omentum out, and that omentum we tunneled subcutaneously, and then used it, spread it out over these areas. So that omentum brought improved blood supply with it, which means we got better antibiotic penetration. So a very simple technique, but can work really, really well when it works. So wound management overall, and again, this would be a several hour webinar if I talk through everything. Wound management really comprises preparing that wound for either open wound management or preparing it for closure. Lavaging. So lavage is really, really important. We want to use large volumes. And again, what I use as lavage fluid entirely depends on that type of wound, how it's been created, what we're going to be doing with it. So acute wounds, so if we get a dog that's been dragged along the road and has got a shearing injury and what have you, those patients, I'm probably going to put onto the tub table and just use the shower head and use tap water to clean that wound out. If it's a more an ongoing wound, I would probably use Hartmann's lactated Ringer solution or saline to clean it. And the other thing that they've looked at in the study was using bottle water. Now I certainly don't go out and buy Evian, but that again is another appropriate option. We want to think about appropriate debridement techniques. So again, just we want to do some surgical debridement. We will do lots of wet to dry dressings. So wet to dry dressings being where you moisten a gauze swab, squeeze it out, it wants to be just moist, pack that into that wound bed, and then you have to wait at least 12 hours, less than 24 hours, because what you want to happen is the fluid that's in that gauze swab wants to dilute kind of any really sticky, gooey exudate, and then you basically put an absorbent layer over the top of that, and then when you come to redress it, the patient needs to be sedated or anaesthetized. Is you rip that gauze swab off, because by that point, the fluid has been absorbed into that secondary layer that's allowed that primary gauze swab to dry down onto that wound. So you're ripping away bacteria, ripping away debris. So those are probably the two most common debridement techniques we use in our hospital. We have got other things, like we talk about. Larval therapy, so use of maggots. I'm going to talk about Aversajet in a second because Aversajet is a debridement unit that we have here as well. We could look at, autolytic debridement, so using a Manuka honey, using hydrogels, things like that with foam dressings. So lots and lots of things available depending on the type of wound, what's going on with it, what point it is in time, what tissues in it we need to remove, what amount of tissues. We're then going to select appropriate dressings, and I'm going to whiz through a little slide talking about dressings in a second, and then we think about reconstruction. Are we going to be able to primarily close this wound? Do we need to do a skin flap like we saw with little Enid the Staffy? Do we leave this wound to heal via secondary intention the whole way through? So when we're looking at wound dressings and what we want a wound dressing to do is we want it to manage exudate effectively. As we said, we want that dressing to absorb exudate and hold it within it, because if it gets too soggy, and making sure again that people change dressings early enough. If you don't change your dressing early enough, it's going to get too soggy and damage that skin. So you want to look at the amount of exudate in the wound and select a dressing to make sure it's absorbent enough. Some of them, these wounds that we can see that are infected and have issues, are producing huge amounts of exudate. And we have to use these kind of super absorbent dressings in that situation. Most of the time a foam will be okay, but again, picking horses for courses, picking the right dressing for the amount of exudate you've got. And as we said, try and have it so it retains it with the dressing. We want to look at managing bacteria. I've mentioned these antimicrobial dressings, which I really love. So managing bacteria both in the wound and in the dressing. So one of the dressings that I like actually destroys the bacterial cell membrane, so the bacteria can't replicate, but it actually gets absorbed into the dressing itself as well. A big thing that's come from human medicine is providing patient comfort. We want these dressings to be comfortable whilst the patient's wearing them, but also what's important is we want them to be comfortable while they're changing those dressings as well. There's nothing worse than knowing an animal hates coming in for a dressing change because it's uncomfortable. So we need to plan, you know, if we do think it's going to be uncomfortable, can we get them some additional analgesia before they come in, or do we need to look at sedating these patients? Also, it wants to be conformable, so we want that dressing to conform really well to that wound bed, to that wound shape. And a lot of the dressings now will swell ever slightly when they come in, when they absorb exudate, so they remain in contact with the wound bed. That dressing is going to provide protection from both further trauma to the wound, but also from bacteria as well. Overall, it's going to create an ideal wound for that environment for that wound to heal. As we said, keep saying it, moist wound environment. We need that to happen for those, you know, those new epithelial cells to leapfrog over each other. We want it to remain warm. We want thermal insulation as well. So again, a lot of dressing and a lot of technology goes into this, particularly for human wounds, to keep that wound at a perfect temperature. And those guest dressings need to allow gas exchange to allow oxygen in and carbon dioxide out. So just to finish on a little bit of the case, this was, and this just highlights what can go wrong. This was a cat that came into us. He had been hit by a car 2 months previously. They had decided to do an amputation for the fracture that he had. The cat had started at 5.7 kilos and was 3.2 kilos when he came into us. His PCB was 16%. This wound had broken down 3 times already, and the practice had swabbed and cultured MRSA. So this was Freddie's wound on presentation. This is, as you can see, this is the remaining, sorry, I'm trying to get my little clicker to work. His remaining femur that you can see left here. So for me, there was a lot of femur sticking out. You can see that it just looks gooey and awful. These are also potentially some vicryl sutures in this patient's skin, which for me is not ideal. So I'll just pop through some of these, which are all very similar. You can see that is not looking good at all, as well as the fact that they cultured multidrug resistant bacteria. We decided that we were going to re-swab it again ourselves just to see what we grew. And as well as growing MRSA, we cultured a multidrug resistant E. coli and a multidrug resistant hemolytic E. coli. So he had 3 different types of multidrug resistant bacteria infecting that wound. We made sure we got him onto appropriate antibiotics. One of the things that we also did early on is we placed an esophagostomy tube because he had lost a significant amount of weight. This wound is also going to take a lot of calories, a lot of protein to get it to heal, full stop. You can see that wound still, it hadn't entirely broken down, but you can see, you know, this here, we were concerned this was all going to go, and we actually went in and removed those sutures. I'll show you those in a second. So when we stop and think about Freddie, what his issues were, you know, all the common reasons why we see delayed wound healing, and think about what he had going on in his wound. For me, the only thing that wasn't really an issue was he wasn't on steroids. You know, the etiology, he'd sustained trauma, there's obviously infection. That bit of femur sticking out, that's still there, it wiggled around. There was loads of movement. We've got from body foreign material, we've got those vicryl sutures, we've still got some necrotic tissue when we look at it. He's anemic, so he's got poor blood supply. We know he's got poor nutrition, he's lost almost half his body weight. Overall, he's not a well cat. There's probably local factors, there's probably iatrogenic factors. When we talk to the owners about what they've been doing in terms of dressings and wound and dealing with that wound, they were given some flamazine ointment, and it was left as an open wound where they applied flamazine to it. Also on discussion, and one of the things we always talk about when we have wounds that aren't healing and when we're concerned about MRSA, is both owners worked in, one in a geriatric care home and one in a human hospital as well. So again, extra risk factors for this patient developing multidrug resistant infections. So just to whiz through some of them, what we did was we used honey on gauze swabs. Early on, we actually tied it over with an antimicrobial dressing. We did these tie over bolus dressings where you have loops of suture material around the outside, which you can see, and they are then used to kind of shoelace that whole dressing in place. This was us kind of when we were trying to not undo everything on him. So you can see we kind of pack in these honey soak swabs into that patient's wounds, but actually it was just the whole thing was breaking apart in front of us. These are another kind of, we would term mechanical debridement as a wet to dry dressing. This is another kind of mechanical debridement, I think. Dressing is the wrong word. So basically these are called Debrisoft and you moisten them with some saline and they're a little bit like sheepskin. For me, they kind of exfoliate the surface of that wound. They're not going to get rid of big, big, big volumes of necrotic tissue. But actually, if you've got a little bit of kind of debris on the surface of that wound, they use them a lot in people where they've got a little bit of superficial gravel. You basically wet them and kind of polish the skin. So we were doing this to on him on a regular basis. There you can see that whole thing was just looking like it was going to break down. So we opened the whole lot up. He was difficult to manage. We put a urinary catheter into him, but he would get diarrhea as well when we started feeding him. So that wound was just in the worst possible location. So basically, we can continue to treat it. It took us 3 weeks and we re-swabbed him weekly to see what we grew. Because we were basically trying to get to the point where he didn't have any multidrug-resistant bacteria, which we got to that point 3 weeks later. We've already done it, but you can see we removed the remainder of that femur because it was just creating a lot of movement. And this is just a little video. This is using a VersaJet. So a VersaJet basically is a machine that fires saline up to 1,000 miles per hour down a handpiece. So this is what's happening now, and I'm going to talk over it. So basically a VersaJet you can turn up to 10. So if you use it on a level 1 or 2, it'll basically just lavage that wound a little bit. We normally use it on a 6 or a 7, so it cuts away. Because that saline is firing so fast, it cuts away tissue. So really useful for burns patients, really useful for shearing injuries where they go all the way down onto the bone, because you can use this VersaJet all the way down onto the periosteum of the bone. The really other cool thing about it is because it's firing saline so fast past that little window that's on kind of the underside of this handpiece. So under here is a little window that the saline fires past. Because it's firing really quickly, it creates what's called the Venturi effect, which means it sucks that saline away. So on the next video, you can see, if I play this next video, 1 second, you can see that saline on the video will get spat down this handpiece and it collects in a bucket. So it means your patient doesn't get really soggy and wet, which we would be really annoying during that procedure. So really, really useful. I don't think everyone's going to go out and buy them. They're pretty expensive of machines. You can get them second hand, and the handpieces are technically meant to be single use, but we obviously will use ours. But there's a limit to the times you can use them. So what we did with Freddie is we actually debrided just the surface of that wound. We wanted it to be a little bit oozy. We wanted to make sure it didn't have that kind of shiny appearance, because we want that when we do the repair, we want that tissue to adhere down really well onto that wound bed. So this is him taking the femur out. That's the last of his femur. Much as we don't normally do, actually, because of all the multidrug resistant bacteria, we actually lavaged it with a very, very, very dilute chlorhexidine solution. We wouldn't normally put chlorhexidine anywhere near healing wounds, but we were concerned about multidrug resistance. And then what we did was basically an advancement flap. So we did an incision here and an incision here, and then pulled this flap forwards, which you will be able to see in a second. So that's doing that. Actually, once we took that femur off, we were left with a lot more skin. So that being sutured in place, we put a couple of active drains into this as well. So you can see that active drain, that's what's sitting beneath the skin. So there's one goes around here and another one goes in at the top. And that's, again, just to create that atmospheric bandage effect so that we don't get a big hematoma, seroma forming underneath that. And that was him at the end of surgery. He went back to his own vet, so we didn't actually ever get any nice, complete, healed photos. But he went on, wound healed, made a full recovery, and all was good. So that's me done. End of the session. If anyone's got any questions, I'm more than happy to answer questions. We still do have 5 minutes left for questions. Even if it's something that I've not really touched on that you kind of thought I may talk about today. Obviously, wounds and wound healing is a massive topic, and we can only cover so much in a 1 hour session, even though I do talk fast. But I'll hand back over and see if any questions have come through.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Louise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.